This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're talking all about the emotions and mental health impact that can surround leaving a job, whether that's by our choice or in situations where a job ends and we did not make that choice. I also feel so compelled to be like, welcome back, even though this episode is just a regular one in your feed, because I've had about 3 weeks off recording episodes. I'm currently recording this intro whilst I'm in Edinburgh working at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, the world's largest arts festival that is very much comedy centric. So it's fun, it's quite intense, but I'm getting to hang out with a lot of my favourite comedians and people that I know in this industry. So yeah, fun, refresh, and feels very needed given we talk about in this episode burnout. And that's one I think I'll be talking about again soon because I can particularly relate recently. Now to talk about this episode, I was chatting with Dr. Abid Nazir, who is a psychiatrist practicing in Chicago in the US. And like I'm reminded of so often when I interview psychiatrists, there's something, whether it's the profession, whether it's the type of people that go into this field, I always walk away having had such a good conversation. Perhaps a lot of that is that blend that I can really connect to of so often those that are at the forefront of this field are people that have such a blend of philosophical perspective on mental health and their role in the mental health of others, but also that evidence-based kind of logical thinking as well. And maybe that's, you know, relatable to me because that's kind of how I live my life and approach a lot of these conversations. So good chats. We covered a lot in terms of today's specific theme, but also we did have a intentional tangent into a lot of the research our guest is involved in. And so I'm actually not going to say too much about that. I'm going to let it come up as it does naturally in the conversation. But we get into some topics near the end of the episode that I have been following closely within the mental health world. And I was really glad to have a professional that's so at the forefront of research to ask some of the questions and get some of the nuance where I'm coming across research in progress, but I'm also coming across concerns, including from other mental health professionals. I wonder if you can guess what it is yet. We'll see if it's what you think. For now, though, we'll get into this conversation with Dr. Abid Nazir in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name's Abid Nazir, and I'm a practicing psychiatrist here in the States. And when I look back at my childhood, especially in teenage years in high school, I remember I was the one where, you know, all my friends would come to want to talk through whatever issues they were having. And I felt like a really empathic listener, was given a lot of good feedback. And that's when it really clicked in my mind that, you know, I want to go into the field of psychiatry. I probably was a bit off on that when I realized later that the field of psychiatry is actually, you need to be an empathic listener, but ultimately being able to help somebody through their problems is actually more the field of psychology and therapy. Luckily, psychiatry does both, but it really started when it was personal. Like every one of us has somebody we know who was suffering, you know, from some sort of mental health symptoms at some point. I had a close friend who ended suicide, and it was something where I wished I could help more. And, you know, then next, my brother started going through some depression symptoms, and I had a couple other friends. I saw so many people suffering from this. Then when I actually saw the impact of when they went and received treatment, of what it did, and I saw such a change in them, that really is where I married the two concepts. Hey, I want to help people through their trauma, you know, help them with their mental health, be a empathic listener, combined with the medical side of actually being able to help somebody through prescribed treatments. That's what called on me. And it's really the only reason that I pursued a career in medicine was to be a psychiatrist. I think I was fortunate in my upbringing. I did not have, you know, I can't really say I suffered through any major mental health issues growing up. You know, I had to go through some trials and tribulations being a minority growing up in the States. That can be challenging at time just to fit in. You know, when I actually was overseas for some time in Pakistan, that I didn't fit in there either. So there were some identity crises for me of where am I? Where do I fit in? But I was pretty much saved from, you know, any actual major episodes for myself. But I definitely saw it around me. And I think that really became my identity is, hey, you know, my identity is I want to pursue a career and field to help others in this space. You know, I can say probably now in my career, it's where it's more on the forefront where I'm struggling. I mean, all medical professionals are starting to struggle with burnout, and I'm starting to feel the effects of anxiety and burnout just with the longevity and the stress of my career. Mm-hmm. So if somebody's never gone through a panic attack and then they finally had one themselves, the ability for you to empathize with your clients and patients goes up dramatically. When you know you've lived through that and how it can feel, it's only, I think, probably helped me to be a better clinician, knowing how it feels. Once I had one of my own, I'm like, wow, it's a whole new level of mm-hmm. empathy for my patients.
And I really appreciate you sharing that on two points, really, because you've highlighted a few things there that I think we still live in a time where there can be a lot of stigma, even within medical communities. There's two things there that, you know, how personal the reasons can be for getting into your field. And secondly, you know, talking about struggles of your own, you know, there can still be this notion of like, but I'm not the patient. I've got to like somehow hold it together. You know, this kind of mentality that I've got to sort of keep all my stuff in as if, you know, we both know mental health isn't that simple.
Yeah. The notion of keeping things in and presenting a face, presenting a front that, hey, I am a blank slate. I am consistent. I am solid. To not just one thing, especially in mental health professionals, you know, it's not just when you're speaking to a client or a patient about it. It's also in personal life. You know, there's an assumption that, well, if you're in the field of helping others through their mental health, you must have your mental health perfectly in control and you are not experiencing these same symptoms to that degree. It's an assumption sometimes that's there, and there's a pressure to keep that facade up. But, you know, I think what I've learned is actually being able to be a little vulnerable at times and share that, you know, we all go through it. I mean, all of us, we're all human beings and can all experience these symptoms. It doesn't matter on what your job title is or where your career path is, you can still experience that. I think I'm pleased and where there's been so much more awareness on burnout and seeking self-care for like the whole medical community and the whole clinician community, anybody who's helping in mental health, all of it. I think there's been a lot more spotlight on this, which is really a lot of progress. You know, I think that's been a really good like forward progress with respect to the mental health of a clinician. Mm-hmm. If you don't have your own mental health, it's going to be really hard to give your best care to somebody else. It starts with self-care. So,
yeah. And that important piece of not judging yourself. There is no like, I should know better or I should have all the answers. You know, this stuff is so complicated. There's a reason why you do a degree and, you know, all these qualifications. And then you're still continually learning through your profession, still trying to ever improve because mental health is a moving object as much professionally as it is for each of us as individuals.
Yes. I mean, I couldn't agree more. I think because there's an expectation to show a solid mental health for of yourself to your clients, that's actually what drives you to suppress the goal of getting treatment for yourself or getting help or being open. It's because you've got to keep that facade up so you know what you need to do. Like a lot of times, you know, clinicians, like especially in the mental health space, when they, you know, we're able to say it to others, but mm-hmm. to practice it on ourselves is actually harder, even though the knowledge is there and the know-how, what we need to do, what the steps are we need to take. But because we are showing we are okay, it's almost like you're ignoring what needs to be done. You don't act on it. You know deep down you need to do the same for yourself, but it's hard to actually make those changes.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think it's so important that those conversations are being had more. That's one less person, you know, for each doctor that's taking that approach that is keeping up this mask of pretending everything's okay. You know, one more person that is instead going to reflect real life back to their patients. A nice thing to see that we're getting more to that place of absolutely, there can be so much like important, stringent ways that we approach medicine, but there are also, you know, very kind of human ways that we need to show care. And we've already highlighted there with you talking about your job and some of the pressures there, I think links well to our theme for today of what happens when a job ends. So maybe we should start off by talking about, you know, some of the pressures in workplaces that commonly affect clients of yours, you know, because that may be one of the reasons why people move jobs.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when we look at the self-employment, that's one of the major things. I mean, it's one of the main things, relationships, you know, your immediate family and those relationships, your job. I mean, that's right up there. And employment can be your identity. It's how you, for a lot of people, like what they do is a part of their identity. And if you're struggling in your current, you know, job, it kind of goes deeper sometimes than, hey, this is a job, it's just not going well, let me just change. And it's not always as simple. You have a certain identity in that position, and some people, they've spent their entire careers in a certain role. And as it becomes challenging in that workplace, whether it's like, I mean, it ranges from, you know, when somebody's suffering from, like, let's say anxiety and panic, and they're in a position and they're having, you know, there's like a, whether it's financial stress at work, or they're, you know, not meeting numbers or targets, or their employer, their direct supervisor is not open and helpful in somebody, you know, to get through their emotional or mental stressors that they're experiencing. Let's say somebody has panic and they need to be able to take time to just step out from a situation. You know, there's fear there of repercussion. There's fear of, well, you know, my identity is being shaken here if I'm not performing. It's seen, for some people, they'll frame it as a weakness. Then there is an apprehension on somebody to admit to any sort of mental health symptoms that they're having and what they need to get through the situation. You know, that's where things like, you know, a lot of times I'm helping people with paperwork, you know, like Family Medical and Leave Act paperwork here in the United States, where we're able to certify somebody to need certain time off. Maybe it's moments at work where they need to be able to step out and breathe and get out of a certain situation to temper down that building anxiety or panic. Sometimes it's hard when somebody is experiencing, let's say, a high amount of stress at work to perform. There might be an environment in their workplace where, you know, it's not welcomed openly for you to bring up that I am, you know, taking a mental health day, or I am trying to keep my mental health okay, and so I can keep being productive in this role. And so a lot of times it's just kind of squashed down. You know, you don't bring it up in your situation. And all that does is just like compound the problem even further, where what starts out as an adjustment reaction for somebody to a stress at work, you know, serotonin levels can drop, but your receptor profiles are still there. And if you get through the stressor, your levels will go back up. But if you continue in the stressor and the job's not changing and it stays challenging and stays, I guess, a place where it's, you're not able to take the time to help yourself to get through it, then it just compounds and it turns into clinical depression. It can turn into clinical anxiety. So I think the types of problems people face at work, you know, it's very different in different fields, different areas I've seen, but the themes are a lot of times the same. There's some employers that I've noticed have diversity, equity, inclusion. They have awareness. They understand mental health. They even provide mental health benefits, you know, specific and extra benefits, you know, but that's definitely not the majority. And I think the majority of workplaces is exactly, you were just framed it, Bobby, where it's, you know, even with my certification on paperwork, or even if they try, it doesn't always come out successful. I've seen many patients and many clients who just leave, they have to leave their employment after they suffer through some sort of an episode or phase where there's mental health is struggling. They've ended up either losing or having to pretty much resign their job.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I've been in those positions where I've been like, this job is affecting my mental health in clear and identifiable ways. I'm not happy here. I'm not likely to get happier. And so maybe it's time I get out. I also want to bring in a parallel that I find very interesting there of there are also times when we absolutely want to leave a job, or maybe we get a promotion in the same workplace. I know myself and various people in my life have had that thing of everything's good and we're very excited and we're 100% happy with the decision. That doesn't mean change is easy necessarily. That doesn't mean we're instantly in that new job, no stress, no impact of having to learn how to do a new job or adjust to new managers or new policies. So yeah, could you share a bit about what you see with clients in terms of the adjustment of leaving, even if it's what they really want?
You always think, you know, sometimes that grass is greener on the other side. So that's one sometimes dilemma is sometimes you find out the grass is not greener on the other side once you leave one position. And even if it's a promotion, it comes with, like you said, added responsibility, added stress, and a whole new mode of operation. Every workplace has its own culture, its own dynamics, its own hierarchy, its own expectations on employees. Like it's different. You really have to kind of learn the language of your workplace. And that is some people will stay in jobs for much longer than they want to and not make that move, even though everything points to the current setup is not sustainable, it's not ideal, it can be better, but the fear of change. Sometimes there's a bubble of comfort. You just don't want to pop. You take what's known to you, even though it's not ideal, you'll take it instead of the unknown. That could be better, but it's an unknown, and you're afraid that it could be worse too, and just making that move. But in general, losing a job. So one thing in leaving or losing a job, like immediately, there's obviously an increase in stress and anxiety, but it has sometimes a lot to do with financial, like uncertainty and the pressure to find another source of income. You know, this can really like cause heightened stress levels and people when they're worrying about meeting their own financial obligation, providing for themselves or their families. That's a huge impact just to transition. There a lot of times is a financial hit as you leave one job. Especially if you lost that job and you have to now find a new one, or even leaving it on your own accord, unless you have something just ready to go and lined up, right? There's that whole self-esteem identity. If you lose a job, that can suffer. I mean, your self-worth is tied a lot of times to your careers. I mean, I know a lot of professionals, just is a big part of it. You know, you look at physicians and lawyers, entrepreneurs, are their identities tied to their business? If something happens where they no longer have that, it makes you question like your own skills, your own abilities, your own purpose. Mm-hmm. And that obviously impacts your mental well-being.
Yeah. How do I introduce myself now even? You know, because we so often default as, oh, this is what I do. That's like one of the first things we'll say about ourselves.
Yeah. You know, it could even go deeper if you've given blood, sweat, and tears into a company, let's say, and really help grow that company, and for whatever circumstances are, and lose that job. I mean, it's also like all that identity is even sometimes tied into a specific company in that career, you know, and that can be tough. I mean, there's a concept also like, well, society places like a lot of significant emphasis on employment status, and like losing the job can really like evoke shame or a sense of like failure, a sense of embarrassment in people. Like, well, I'm not employed, and you know, what does that show outwardly to others, right? And these emotions like add like a sense of conflict and guilt internally, and it really affect your self-esteem as well. And you know, the last part of it, most jobs, and it's a little different now with COVID era, and ever since things have turned a lot more remote, there's a lot more jobs that are siloed, but you know, things are changing. There is still a lot of employment settings where there's a social aspect to it. And like, if you don't have the job suddenly, you know, you have coworkers, colleagues that you are develop social relationships. And we, you know, humans are social animals. We need that. And it's part of our identity. So then you develop social isolation and loneliness when you, you know, have a decrease in your social interactions, opportunities for social connections, like that you just feel isolated. All of that starts triggering more and more depression and negative emotions. So it's like a ripple effect, because if you think about it, when you have all those things happening, what else is going to be impacted is actually relationships, like personal partners, family members, friends, your like children, your spouse, and all of it can get impacted if you don't have a job. It's like ripple effect. So, I mean, it's really important. But I do think, you know, people in general, if they approach it with, I have skill set, I can develop new one, I am focused on why it wasn't ideal in your current circumstance and visualize how it can be better. Go into a new situation with your eyes more open on how it was. Learn from your past experience and how you approach it, and trying to be more, you know, like, you know, try to be more upfront, open, honest, and try to get through it and seek help. And I think it can help. And honestly, sometimes a little break from job, you try to, there's a silver cloud, and there's a spin you can tell yourself sometimes that sometimes you need a little time to decompress, figure out what you want to do going forward. Life is short, and it gives you an opportunity. It's almost a sense of freedom for a second that, so now I do have the world as my oyster here of where I can take my career and my focus.
Yeah.
And, you know, people get trapped. You get trapped in a certain job sometimes. You feel like you have no other angle.
Yeah.
And
no, I know that's been an important balance for me of finding like enough freedom and autonomy balanced with enough kind of comfort, consistency, routine. That's a big thing for, you know, my mental health mixing pot. You've reminded me of like one of the things I've done a few times with that is when I've been keen to leave a job, and something I've found helpful is to tell the new job, oh, I'll be able to start at this date. Add a few weeks maybe if I can, you know, afford to manage that, you know, find ways to kind of make that extra space because I'm going into a new job with however much holiday allocation and all rules on when you can't take it, you know, you're probably going to have to do your training period. So if you can get that rest in first, knowing that you're going to have the stress and the extra pressure of learning so much about this new role. And I don't know, sometimes this feels like it comes back to similar to what we talked about earlier, where as people, we're not always the best at looking after ourselves. And in many ways, I don't think that's an individualized thing. I think we're not always taught it. You know, there's a reason why self-care seems to be something people learn about as much through Instagram ads as from any mental health professional. Like, there's a lot of the information we even do get can be skewed. And so that's been a big one for me, is learning to prioritize and be like, oh, you deserve a break, even in this circumstance, even when people are like, so when is it you're starting your new job?
Right. Yeah, that gap in between, that's an excellent strategy. Obviously, everybody's situation is different. Some people, the financial part of it's there, but if there's a way to get that extra time in, I mean, I've had many clients who are utilized that time, and they almost, you know, and I helped try guiding them through that process from the get-go when they're in their old job and saying, now, like, if I think I need to make a move and make a switch. You know, sometimes we plan treatments, like plan ahead to have some time for them to work on, you know, their own mental health during that break specifically. And sometimes it's people travel. Sometimes we've actually, you know, said, oh, like, we know my clinic, we do IV ketamine therapy and Spravato and transcranial magnetic stimulation. These are time-consuming treatments. You have to spend some time in the clinics, and sometimes we pre-plan it to do it in between jobs. And it really, it's like, really kind of get somebody strengthened up and ready for their next challenge, rather than kind of hobbling out of one job, a little bit beaten and battered from that, and you know, that employment, and going right into the next one. You haven't had a time to decompress and to do some treatment, and or to whatever it takes, whether it's treatment, whether it's travel, whether it's just time to just spend with family and do nothing. That's good too. That can be rejuvenating for some. So yeah, I mean, utilize the transition for your benefit. Let it be a positive that you get this opportunity between jobs, right? Like, look at the ways you can have it help the situation.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, one of the smaller examples, just because I can be quite a logical person, is I love to do the maths. I love to like take the time to be like, okay, we're budgeting, we're going to go into this, you know, and if it's a better financial situation in the new job, let's really make the most of that. You know, let's cancel that. subscription that I never watch anymore. Like, you know, there's right. there's things that, like, the kind of life admin stuff we can catch up on even.
We got to trim things, and kind of that's the time to, like, you know, relook at everything. Your finances, your work-life balance, how you want to operate, how are you going to carve out your time allocation? Mm-hmm. You know, what's the balance? Because people lose balance, obviously. That's part of burnout. It's heavily skewed towards work. Even the pressure on you put on yourself, you know, like for me personally, you know, I've worked in many jobs in my career, and I've left many times a job. It's not, I know some people don't make that many career or job switches, and some people make a lot more. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, people generally tend to switch several times over the course of their lifetime. I mean, that's a part of it, but I always want to leave on good terms, right? That's always my goal, is to part ways in a way where all the relationships are intact, and it was kind of a mutual understanding that I'm leaving, and it's not on any contentious, you know, foundation. So that usually requires giving time notice to your current employer ahead of time and trying to get as much time pushed back on previous employer in a good spot. Now, sometimes it doesn't work that way. It can be and dramatic, and there's not much to salvage in that relationship. So I'm not saying it's for everybody, but if you are one who tends to, if it's more about finding a new opportunity that suits you better, not about that the current job has been, you know, tumultuous and contentious. It's been generally okay, but it's just not the right fit anymore. You know, I think me being on the employer side, I'm an employer and I've been employee and employer. So I understand the concept of somebody working with you to transition out. There's a nice collaboration there that, you know, I've had it where I've had employees leave and stay engaged and come back later at a later time in their career. Or people I've stayed in touch with where I've left it, you know, they've left my the job. So just other food for thought, I think, this whole discussion.
Yeah, no, I'm a big believer in that. Like, keep what social connections you can. The last kind of regular person job I left, things have kind of gone downhill at that workplace since. And I'm in touch with enough people that still work there to kind of have these perspectives. And it's interesting kind of how our kind of commitment, our sort of loyalty changes. You know, that when you're in a job, particularly when it's a, you know, high stress or kind of toxic workplace or all these other factors that can really just sort of tunnel vision even more than we already would. And, you know, it's something that's taking up the majority of our waking hours. It is a nice thing. And to me, 100% has the mental health benefits of, like, that point where you realize, okay, I'm psychologically out of that workplace. Because it's not necessarily the day you leave, you know, but the day that, like, I start realizing, oh, some things have gone wrong. Oh, some things aren't being done the way I used to do them. And it's really not my problem anymore. And I no longer feel invested beyond, you know, the people I'm still in contact with, and they're a part of it.
It's a light bulb moment and a relief when you, I think, if you leave and then you set, and then you get word of what's happening there, and it's almost triggering the first, like, wow. Because
you want to run in and save them. Yeah.
You're consumed and it is tunnel vision, and it eats up all the mental space you have once you're in one of those environments. And it can really have an impact, like, on all layers of your life when you are just stuck in the middle of a tumultuous job situation. And it's like you wake up thinking about it. You're dealing with it all day. You go home. You can't unwind. You're thinking about it. And now suddenly you're hearing about it and you realize, oh, well, great. You know, this is no longer my problem. I played. That could be liberating. You know, I think wonders for somebody's mental health once you have that realization. But you're right, it's a process to take the claws out of you from a previous workplace. It doesn't happen overnight. You know, usually that's a transition process there. So
for sure. And yeah, I think it's so worth it. I love to quit jobs. It's one of the things I'm most proud of. I've never stayed in any job for a significant period of time longer than I've wanted to. You know, sometimes there has been that kind of strategizing of, oh, maybe this isn't the job for me as much as I thought it was, but how can I make the best of the situation? Maybe I do 6 months here, I save up some money, I learn what I can, and I get out, you know, sooner than I planned. So there can still be that sort of strategizing that I find helpful. But, you know, overall, when it started going that way in my mind, I've nearly immediately started planning. Like you say, it's not always easy to do that. And we can have this kind of bubble of, you know, comfort, even in uncomfortable circumstances. But my two cents is, It can be so worth it, Bobby.
That's like an excellent strategy, because leaving jobs, I think it's about identifying when it's not the right fit for you, that something should change, not then getting overwhelmed by this is too much for me, it's not the right situation, and focusing only on that. It's about planning then, and it's okay to not leave right away then, but you'll feel some sense, because I kind of operate in a similar way as you, and how if I'm leaving a job, it's about planning out the whole process and kind of having a game plan. And that alleviates a lot of the stress when you are knowing that you're following through with the game plan. You got to look at what your skill set is, what the job market is, where your next move's going to be, when the timeline will be, how you want to phase out, and what that strategy is. As long as you have it kind of all mapped out, I think it makes it a lot easier than trying to do it as a reaction to some situation, or do it impulsively or quickly. And it's okay if you know you're staying in it longer. You know what? This is going to be a 6-month process for me to get out. There's light after that. You already know where the light is at the tunnel. You know how far out it is.
Oh, yeah. That's something I recommend to people all the time, even if they're like friends of mine that are complaining about their job a lot. I'll be like, apply for some others anyway. And they'll be like, oh, no, I'm like happy here. I'm going to stay. I'm like, well, then applying for a job and getting offered it and not taking it will confirm your decision. But, you know, surprise, surprise to everyone but me, oftentimes they do get offered some other jobs and they're like, oh, it's been a reminder that there are other options out there.
Yeah, validation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this workplace doesn't validate me, but yeah, but I have skills other people recognize.
Exactly. And that really helps, I think, knowing your worth and being validated and having that other offer. Okay, you don't have to take it. And that should count for something if you really don't want to take it.
Yeah.
As long as you're not taking it out of fear, you know you're miserable, and you're just not taking it out of the stress and fear of your current situation, that, you know, that's probably not the best approach. But if you are choosing to not take
to stay. This is it. Then you have the reminder of like, oh, well, actually, you know, maybe it's the commute that's keeping me here, or maybe it's certain benefits I get at work. You know, like there are things that I can value here, and sort of reframe that. And, you know, clunky transition talking about reframing, something that's been kind of understood more and researched more that you're very involved in, like you mentioned, is psychedelics and kind of newer waves of medical practice that, you know, I feel like in the States you're maybe more at the forefront than here in Ireland. So could you share a bit about your involvement with that?
Yeah, I mean, that is kind of where my focus has been the last 6 years. It really started like when, you know, I opened up my own practice about 6 years ago in Chicago, Illinois, and it was for the purpose of, you know, having ketamine, IV ketamine treatment available here. There were no clinics here at all. It was the first psychiatric ketamine practice. And, you know, and I knew the data on it. Like, you know, I was following the data, like going back to like a landmark study by the National Institute of Mental Health here. Had a study back in 2013, and it showed the framework of how we can actually offer IV ketamine to a patient for treatment-resistant depression, showed 70%, you know, remission, strong response rates, and that's astronomically high compared to what we were used to with traditional approach of SSRIs and SNRIs, which have a lot, like, based on, you know, some landmark studies on meds, general medication, like the STAR-D trial from, you know, it's been well over now, about 15 years ago or more, but that comparison of like all the SSRIs, SNRIs showed like 30% efficacy, right? And this is much higher. And I saw it immediately in my first patient that, wow, this is rapid. And not only was it just symptom management. So that's one thing, you know, like sometimes medications can be a bit just symptom management where you're managing the symptoms with a, let's say a Prozac or a Zoloft or something like that, an SSRI. This was like, where the field was all psychoanalytical for some decades and therapy, Freudian-based, and then advent of like when psychopharmacology kind of exploded and they really understood the concepts of serotonin and discovered SSRIs, then it turned into biological like approach. Everything was med, and it swung all the way to the other side. And where it should be is a sweet spot in the middle that you are approaching it medically and psychologically to get to the core of what's causing it. And that's what psychedelics and ketamine are doing. and leading to really high success rates. So it causes this concept of neuroplasticity is where the future of this field is, which is, you know, it's basically rebuilding broken highways in the brain when it stops communicating it to each other. Those neuronal, you know, transmission highways have potholes and are broken. And, you know, different treatments like ketamine or psychedelic medicine, like in the future, like psilocybin and MDMA that are, you know, going through the FDA process, they promote neuroplasticity, wake up the brain, fix those potholes. So you can now mold your perspective. Like medically, you're getting actually new pathways formed, which allows you to, you know, get out of that rigid, narrow highway thinking and neuronal transmission. And then psychologically, because of the altered state of consciousness from these, you know, type of medicines, it allows you to like reframe. I've had patients reframe trauma because they're able to revisit the trauma with vivid clarity and a new vantage point, a new perspective, but without all the associated negative emotions, anxiety and anger and fear from it. Pairing that with psychotherapy, it's amazing results. And then even if you're not liking that altered state of consciousness, I have patients who have been getting ketamine treatment for years who don't really like the treatment that much because they get anxious from it, despite how much we try to work through it, but they still get it, they still maintain because of neuroplasticity and the symptom relief and the improvement in their depression or PTSD or addiction or whatever we're using it for is so dramatic that they'll still come in and it's worth it. Mm-hmm. So that's the field I've kind of been in, is like these newer treatments and how do they integrate with the old paradigm. We still do med management. We use genetic testing a lot. We still do psychotherapy. And we know how our goal is now to marry the two. That's also causing neuroplasticity. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like...
And I want to pause on that for a second to do a bit sort of neuroplasticity 101, because it is a fascinating concept, but one that, you know, I think not everyone will be familiar with, right? This idea that our brain, you know, physically changes as we kind of learn, as we grow older, as we go through different experiences in our lives. And so oftentimes when things are really bad with our mental health and certain conditions like PTSD can be easier to describe perhaps on this, because there can be this direct, you know, trigger events, memories flashing back, emotional response to that. And so there are a number of ways that we can break that pattern and we can sort of change it and work to sort of ease it, if nothing else. And so like you've described, that could be, you know, therapy, it could be talking through elements of it, it could be reframing certain things, working on parts of the PTSD until a lot of these kind of triggering events don't have the same kind of instantaneous, unmanageable emotional effect on us. But then there can also be things like eye movement desensitization and reprogramming, where that's again, maybe one of these sort of more in-between approaches where there's elements of hypnosis, there's elements of kind of tackling the automation that our brain is doing without necessarily going into the flashbacks and trying to find different ways around how we reprogram here. And so am I right in understanding with this? It's another approach there where potentially you can kind of go into experiences without the same emotional response to sort of lessen somebody's response to it over time, but also that you're seeing a certain amount of neuroplasticity being caused even more directly by these substances.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely described it, you know, very well. And so there are many things that can enhance neuroplasticity and to different degrees.
Do we still believe that fish oil does that? Because I have dyslexia and fish oil was really just thrown my direction.
Yes. And like, here's my philosophy on things like that, the fish oil. So there's evidence to show it that yes. And sometimes in the academic world, when you look at evidence-based medicine, right, sometimes you have to have a certain threshold of evidence before there's full-on field-wide, like, yep, here's what we're doing, fish oil acceptance, exactly. To me, the evidence base is there. And it's definitely there and it's building, but it might not meet that threshold yet. If there's little downside to it, like for the risk-benefit analysis, skews in benefit versus risk, like I'm all for it. Like it should be there. Like it's all about what tools can we find that can help us in the situation. Fish oil? 100% yes. I would say, because what's really taking, you know, fish oil really is not going to provide that much.
Well, it has, yeah, it has other benefits as well, right? That's like, I really like that we've stumbled onto this, because it is a, yeah, it's a good way of looking at it, is like, what is the cost benefit analysis? And like we know, you know, that is one of the biggest things that can hold people back when it comes to taking medication is, okay, what are the side effects? And are some of these side effects going to outweigh the potential benefits? And so with this in mind, where are we in terms of research around these kind of, you know, psychedelic experiences of the cost benefit analysis? Where is the science at this point?
Right. So, you know, it's different with like where ketamine is versus, which is not a true psychedelic, to be honest, for looking at it pharmacologically. However, it has similar mechanisms with, you know, brain-derived neurotropic factor. That's the signal that what ketamine has a downstream effect of releasing that. And I give an analogy as like somebody on a blowhorn calling the construction workers to repair those highways and rebuild those neuronal transmission pathways. That's what BDNF is. It's the messenger. It's the conductor of that. And ketamine's robust with BDNF release. And that's why we get a lot of neuroplasticity very quickly versus other things might be more subtle with time, you know. However, ketamine's data goes back a long time now that, okay, 2005 was probably one of the first earlier studies. And there's not much going on in the space then. But since 2013 and that landmark study at NIMH, now there's like hundreds and hundreds of papers. And again, at this point, I have to say, when we look at people who comes to me looking for this treatment, many times it's people that have tried SSRIs, and SNRIs are considered treatment resistant. Sometimes it's because of their genetic makeup. Sometimes it's just because the meds can have a lot of side effects. And that's why they're maybe metabolizing it slower, fast, or it's just not working. It's just not effective. So then what's the risk benefit analysis? If somebody comes to me and says, I am having thoughts of ending my life. This is my last resort. I can't try another medicine. Oh, I already did all these medicines I just rattled off. I've been in therapy my whole life. I've even done electroconvulsive therapy. I've done TMS, even transcranial magnetic stimulation. Nothing's working. To me, it's the risk benefit is very skewed in favor of trying something like psychedelics or ketamine treatment. Now, ketamine and psychedelics in general, so we know ketamine can be bad for you if you're taking it every day illicitly or doing whole ketamine regularly. The more you take of something, that can have a negative impact psychologically, dependent on it, can cause bladder toxicity, cognitive issues. However, if you do it in a medical setting and you're doing very minute microdoses, controlled, sporadic, according to the medical paradigm, you know, we're not seeing that produce negatives like that. Yes, it's short and intense. Psychedelics more so intense because and longer duration, like psilocybin and MDMA are like you take a dose, like according to the MAP study. I mean, there's two doses of MDMA for PTSD. It's higher doses, two therapists with you. It's an 8-hour dosing session that happens twice, and it's packaged with a lot of psychotherapy. It gets deep into the root cause and reframe things, not to mention all that medical benefit. So the data is not enough yet for FDA approval, but we're on track. I mean, I know MDMA is hoping for approval in Q1 to 2024, and for MDMA, for PTSD, Compass Pathways is primarily the company behind psilocybin, and they're also in phase 3 trials, so they're getting towards the end, so it might come later next year or 2025. There's a nice domino effect happening here, and it obviously remains to be seen if the FDA will approve it or not, but to be honest, so far the data is hard to deny. You know, it might not be for everybody, but for many people who have failed treatments, it's a very solid option. And the place to start now is ketamine treatment. I caution people, it feels as easy as taking rolling on ecstasy at a party and now you're not going to have anxiety, or illicitly using ketamine somewhere, or going somewhere and just getting ketamine and that's it, and now you're fine. You know, it's not that simple. Like the data all is linked with therapy connected. And with ketamine, it's important that you are getting it with there's a psychiatric treatment team element to it. You can't just get ketamine and everything's going to fix. You need to be screened. You need to have the therapeutic alliance. You need to be able to manage expectations.
Yeah. No, I appreciate you sharing that as well, because I think that is a lot of the pushback that I see, that the science is coming forward, but understandably, the same kind of mental health medical community that such a big part of various people's roles can be to support people getting off substances like and including these, then the idea of them being given on purpose in a medical capacity can be a difficult one to, you know, to wrap your head around and to think about the appropriateness of that. You know, the pushback of people, you know, potentially saying, why these drugs?
One thing to remember with psychedelics is actually with like psilocybin, LSD in general, and even ketamine, their utility for treatment of addiction, like substance use disorders, it's really good. We don't actually find withdrawal syndromes and like physical tolerance dependence and withdrawal syndromes. When utilizing for good in the right medical paradigm, we know it helps treat substance use disorders. We typically, when you look at morbidity and mortality of psilocybin and LSD specifically, they're two of the lowest mortality and morbidity, negative impact, addiction potential is actually the lowest out of when they look at like a list of 30 substances, like when you look at alcohol, nicotine, cocaine, opioids, benzodiazepine, these all have much higher. And anything that actually develops a physical tolerance, dependence, withdrawal, where you're stuck on it, that can be a lot more problematic. But even in that space, there's a concept of harm reduction. So like when we look at, let's say, the data for the use of buprenorphine, so, which is Suboxone is the old brand name of it, or methadone, there's a lot of data showing how it lowers overdose rates, it improves outcomes, and it's really about managing the symptoms of withdrawal and your physiological imbalance so you can get the real treatment. What's the real treatment? It's not the methadone, it's not the buprenorphine, it's not the ketamine, it's not the psilocybin or the LSD. The real treatment is the therapeutic work surrounding it. But to be able to do that, your body and mind have to be primed and in control, not in withdrawal, not craving. The dopamine surges have to be relaxed. And then you need to be able to get to the root, what's driving the substance. These kind of newer treatment approaches with like altered states of consciousness let you actually get to the bottom of it. And it's a tool to help therapy. So that, and it just accelerates it and it lubricates it and it makes your brain moldable so you can think of a new pattern and let the concrete dry in a new way. So it's exciting times, but safety matters. It's not for everybody, that's for sure. But I do know there's an epidemic of suicide happening right now. And these are known to be, especially ketamine. I haven't had any tools in my career as a psychiatrist that worked as effectively as ketamine or even now the nasal spray that's FDA approved here, Spravato, intranasal esketamine. Many, many uses of it for people. You know, it could be temporary, it could be maintenance, but as long as it's done right, that's the key.
No, I appreciate you sharing that because I think like many things with mental health, it's all about the nuance. You know, the example that springs to my mind is even in, you know, addiction services where I highlighted like that may be one of the areas pushback comes from this emerging science. There's still the nuance there of often, you know, part of somebody's treatment of getting off addictive substances is prescribing that substance at controlled rates in ways that are kind of medically controlled in environments that are safe as possible. And, you know, so I think, you know, that nuance has always been there. And so I'll be interested to kind of see how this progresses. Yeah, and what the best practices become. So we'll wrap up there then. Thank you so much for sharing your work, sharing your perspective on our main theme today. If people want to find out more about what you do, where should they go online?
Yeah, so they can go to hopemarkhealth.com, HOPEHEALTH. HopeMarkHealth.com. That's the name of my practice. We have 5 locations, the Chicagoland area.
Beautiful. And on that note, then we'll wrap up there and we'll have a bit more of a catch up behind the paywall. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.